My name is Victor Kubik. Welcome to Inside United. With us today is Stephen Britt. He's one of our newest ministerial trainees here at the home office. He is married. His wife is Danielle. And they just had a little girl. They just said Lalena is her name. He's a PhD in mathematics. He's lived in Israel. He's been an author of a number of recent articles and beyond today. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Mr. Kubik.
Okay, it's good to have you here. And we're looking forward to talking about one of your articles in Beyond Today magazine, which was just written for the May-June issue, but it's in conjunction with the 70th anniversary of Israel as a state, which is entitled Israel at 70, an amazing story it is. Anyway, welcome, and let's talk about this article.
All right, yeah, so the article, maybe one kind of relevant thing was that I lived in Israel for a couple of years, somewhat recently, and that helped me gain some of the perspective. And, I guess anyone could go and just learn the history no matter where in the world they live. But while I was living there, I had a special interest in it because it was all around me every day, and I was kind of keeping up on the news there more than any normal person would do, just because I wanted to understand the things I was seeing around me and the situation while I was there. And they also, just within the country, they have a lot of kind of self-education for the Jewish people, because you have them immigrating there from all over the world, and they're trying to understand their history, trying to understand the history of the state of Israel and how they can connect to it. So I attended a number of public lectures, for example, mm-hmm. that gave, some of the history. And usually those were things even a little more specific and intimate than what's found in the article. And some of it was really, really fascinating.
I know I've traveled overseas quite a bit. The places that I write about most effectively are those that I've been to.
Yeah, and I can imagine.
because you know the geography, you know what the mm-hmm. people are like, even though it's like to get on a bus.
Yeah, right.
You know, some of the earthier aspects of that. But, well, Steve, I'm fascinated by a couple of things that I still have a hard time really understanding. The Jewish people themselves, it's amazing how they have been in diaspora for thousands of years, mm-hmm. and yet they have maintained their ethnicity everywhere in the world, whether it be in Israel or whether it be in Central Asia. Like we talked before the podcast here, mm-hmm. I had traveled to Uzbekistan and had seen synagogues, Jewish tombstones, with Hebrew writing on them, of people that were Jews that were still never returned from the captivity of Nebuchadnezzar, from Daniel's captivity, but they had migrated in a different direction, and yet they maintained their ethnicity. What I'm amazed of is, my wife's background is Norwegian. A lot mm-hmm. of people have this or that background. Well, after a generation or two, they forget their background. Most people don't have a clue as to who they are, but the Jewish people have maintained that ethnicity and identity. Can you comment some more about that,
from your experience? Yeah, sure. And, and if you point back to the article, the country has been in its current form for about 70 years, right? And they've done a lot to try to forge a national identity, bringing Jews in from all over the world out of the diaspora. And that's one of the really cool things culturally about being there is they have almost like a factory for, teaching you the language and teaching you the history and the culture and getting you kind of assimilated in there for people who are Jewish going there. And I mentioned culture for this reason, I'm getting around to my point. The cultural practices that set the Jews apart, set them apart in the time of ancient Israel and sets them apart today, things like keeping the Sabbath, the dietary mm-hmm. laws, the things that make those physical distinctions between people over time, keeps their community tight-knit. And, I think especially in the centuries since the time of Christ, you've seen the Jewish community become more and more tradition-based and more insular for that reason, trying to make a concerted effort to preserve their culture and identity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've traveled with Jewish people and Jewish professors and so forth, and I found that yes, they talk about their Jewishness, so to speak.
Right.
But the religion, while they have it as a form, oftentimes is not the practice.
Yeah, and that's something that I've certainly seen an entire spectrum. You've got the ultra-Orthodox who are full on, you know, black suit and black hat and everything, and then you've got people who are Jewish and identify that way, but you know, maybe they light a candle on the Sabbath and maybe they don't, you know, and that might be, you know, lighting that candle might be the one Jewish thing they do in their household in terms of practice, but yeah, yet they still ethnically, you know that they're Jewish. And I mean, my only explanation could be just the weight of that cultural tradition to preserve who they are. And, you know, maybe even dating back to the practices that we read about in the Bible where they kept long genealogies because it was important who was a Levite, who was a priest, who was qualified for these various things. And maybe just as a people, they've always had this obsession with identity.
That's a very good point because they have those writings and the writings have been preserved. They've been preserved, you know, so religiously, literally religiously over the years. You say that the situation there is a very complex one.
Yes.
I know that when I traveled to Jordan, this was about 12 years ago, 13 years ago, and we met with friendly Jordanians, you know, the people that we have worked with. And they were so friendly that by the time that we came to the very end of our visit, we had dinner, and they leaned over to me and said, "You Americans just don't understand the situation. you just don't understand us. You don't understand the Palestinian situation. You don't understand who we are." And while they weren't commenting directly on the Jewish people, nonetheless, you know, they were commenting about the tension in the Middle East. Anything that you could say about that?
Yeah. Well, I think just from living in Israel, one of the axioms that you hear, you'll hear first day when you get there is that for every two Jews, there are three opinions. And one of the things that just struck me is, interesting and maybe something that gets simplified in the American news cycle is that, you know, we say this all the time, that Israel is a democracy, right? The only democracy in the Middle East. But what that means is that they're you know, highly self-critical, the same way that our government's highly self-critical. You know, it doesn't matter who we have in office, you've always got the opposition that's more or less half the country against them. And it's very much that way, that you have a multitude of opinions. And you know, people see Israel as Benjamin Netanyahu, who's kind of more the right-wing conservative side of things, and he's been the leader in that country for longer than any other prime minister now. But that's not without opposition from within their own government. So constantly, you know, you're hearing from pro-Palestinian protest of Israeli Jewish people, even have on within those who are extremely religious, the ultra-Orthodox, you have many of those who say that, well, we had no right to set up a state until, you know, the Messiah comes. He was the one supposed to do this. So really, we should back off and give the Palestinians, you know, what's theirs. And I think that, you know, that kind of internal dialogue gets missed and everyone just thinks of Israel as this one monolithic, you know, anti-Palestinian block when, I mean, especially I lived in Tel Aviv, and it is by far one of the more liberal cities in the country. I don't think I met a single person there who was in favor of, you know, their government having, you know, taking control or annexing any of the Palestinian territories. I don't think I met a single one.
I'm just amazed as to Israel at the smallness of it. It's the size of New Jersey, and it's surrounded by hundreds of millions of people who are hostile towards it.
Right.
And, of course, Israel holds it at bay, probably much to do with a nuclear option.
Yeah. It's things are always heating up the Gaza. You've got, let's see, in the north, Syria seems like it's on the way out of its civil war, which means that that'll probably start to heat up again. You know, that's kind of been on pause since the Syrian conflict started. And, you know, there's always the specter of trouble with Lebanon again. That's not really settled up there. In fact, I took a visit to a little town called Matula. It's off on the very northern border, and it's a wonderful place to stay, a nice little, you know, Jewish community. And there's a cool river, a national park, actually. We had national park passes. We went to all kinds of hiking and as well as archaeological parks, all kinds of things. But, you know, you look across the little river, and it goes through a canyon there, and that separates you from Lebanon, and you've got tanks pointed at you from the other side, and sometimes you'll see kind of scary looking things like that. But you've also got probably about 4 million Palestinians within Israel, is the number I've heard. And so even within their own borders, you've got substantial numbers of people that would rather not have them there.
Well, I have spent a couple of weeks in Israel, but this was back in 1969. Actually, it was a momentous time. It was 2 years after the Six-Day War. And we went to the Golan Heights and to Quneitra. There were still burned out tanks that were there. We were told not to get off the road because of mines and that type of thing. So it was still surreal to see.
Yeah. You go up in that area even today, you know, as you're driving along the roads, you'll see a sign that says, you know, warning, landmines. And then you'll see like a cow meandering through. And it's like, well, I guess that's one way to find the landmines and stuff. But yeah, the remnants of that are still there. And a lot of that, you know, they'll turn some of their fortified positions from prior conflicts into, like a modern kind of memorial to that conflict. And, you know, places that were important battlegrounds in biblical times are still used in that way today. It's that way in Beersheba. They have, you know, Tel Beersheba is the archaeological park. And right there on top of it, back in, you know, early 1900s, the British built a little command post, because it was a good vantage point. It was a good vantage point. Thousands of years ago and still is today.
Well, one of the places that I found most interesting about that was in the area of Megiddo, where there were caves and there were these types of lookout places. And you can see how over that valley that was a place where the battle would take place.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you get a chance to get to Gaza?
I did not go into Gaza, actually. From what I understand, you can take trips in and out of there, but it was not something I was interested in doing at the time.
Well, our tour bus actually went right through Gaza.
Oh, wow.
But we were told not to get off the bus, and the stairs from the public were not what I would say friendly stairs. But I can imagine how things have gotten much, much worse.
So we moved there in October of 2015. It was at the height of what became known as the knife intifada. You know, every other day there were stabbings either in Jerusalem, there were shootings in Tel Aviv while we were there, kind of a lot going on. And from Gaza specifically, there were rockets being fired into Israel. In fact, there's an app I had on my cell phone that would tell me whenever rockets were fired. And, I figured out later that, they have it set up where you can say, well, I'm in Tel Aviv, so don't notify me unless it's relevant for Tel Aviv. So at first I was getting all the rockets that were fired in my phone would go off in the night. And, I was aware of it. The one trip that we did take into the Palestinian territories, we went to, give me a second. We took more of a guided tour to Bethlehem, which is a Palestinian city. But, the Palestinians that we did meet and interact with mostly were friendly and friendly towards Americans. And, were more or less regular people trying to live their lives. I think that often on both sides, you have radical elements that are fueling these fires and especially fueling the protests and violence and things like that. And even that goes both ways. So for one example, the Temple Mount's one of the big flashpoints of violence, obviously, because it's one of the most contested places and controversial places. So on the one hand, you would see a group of, innocent Jewish people just going up there to see the sites. And out of the mosque that's up there, all the Muslims gather together in there and yell, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, over and over again. This very intimidating, kind of a war cry almost. And sometimes things would get heated with the guards that were stationed up there on the Muslim side. On the other hand, you have radical Jewish activists who every once in a while try to sneak something up there and do something really inappropriate, like some kind of attack even, or something like they try to sneak a lamb up there in their backpack to sacrifice, or some strange thing like this. The scene is very provocative given the political nature of the situation at the moment.
Well, one thing about the Bible is that the Bible speaks of the restoration of Israel, a glory of Israel, God's love for Israel, and the end of the story is such a wonderful story.
Absolutely.
And how do people revere those words? Do they look to them as kind of their battle cry even?
You know, in my experience, what I saw a lot of that I was surprised by were people who felt like they were fulfilling that today. And you know, to me as an outsider, I found that very strange, because you see the people with guns everywhere and you see like these attacks everywhere. And you also see a place that's a little desolate, even from, I'm from Georgia. It's very green in Georgia compared to Israel. Whereas in biblical times, we're told it was a much more lush place, a much more beautiful place. They've had this whole thing of how they're pushing back the desert in Israel by their agricultural programs and irrigation. And it's still quite desolate in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And I think there is this tendency, people tend to feel very important when they go to Israel for some reason. In fact, they have this whole thing about Jerusalem madness. Jerusalem madness is the syndrome they say when an American goes over there and basically they start to think that they're Moses or Elijah or something like this. And they think they're some important biblical character and it becomes a problem. But at the more realistic level, people go over there thinking, well, this is where I'm supposed to worship and I'm supposed to, this is a fulfillment of the people returning to Jerusalem. And they're kind of blind to the reality the reality of, it's not peaceful there and it's not fully restored there right now, but also lacking that vision of exactly what the kingdom of God will be like, mm-hmm. and the waters flowing forth and everything blooming, that large swath of desert, just bursting forth with water and green things. And I mean, that's one of the amazing things is that every time they irrigate one of these places, everything grows and it works beautifully. And you can just tell that when God opens these things up in his time, it will be wonderful. And to have the peace there, there's on the Israeli side, there's this tendency to harden themselves against any kind of attack, right? They're like, we're going to carry on no matter what. And that gives them a type of peace, and a show of peace that it doesn't matter if the bombs are going to fall today, I'm going to be at the factory doing my job today. And it has allowed them to be very successful in the world market, having that mentality. But on the other hand, it does kind of blind people, I think, to the fact that, no, real peace is something that's not a face you put on. It's mm-hmm. something that comes from God and something that will include everyone.
Well, it's an amazing story, of Israel as we see physical Israel. We see its history, and we're looking forward to that time when it'll all come together with the return of Jesus Christ, who himself was a Jew.
Yes.
Israelite, and where that way of life— and the values of what's biblical and eternal will be passed on to all mankind to benefit from. Well, Steve, there's just so much more we can say.
I think that
we've just kind of started this discussion, and that's all the time that we have here today. But I'd like to talk more again very, very soon. I'd like our listeners
to
come back here to hear more from Steve. I'd like to hear more about this. I think our listeners would like to hear more from somebody who was right there on the scene and can comment on it.
All right, thank you.
So thank you for joining us on Inside United. Please come back again soon to hear more.
This is a production of the United Church of God. For more, visit ucg.org.